This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The TMZ Rob Reiner documentary, probably the first of many, just dropped this last week and confirmed what a lot of us suspected and really couldn't prove. Sources with direct knowledge say Nick Reiner reportedly admitted to killing his parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner, but allegedly doesn't understand why he's in jail. He believes he's the victim of a conspiracy, according to sources with TMZ. His medication for schizoaffective disorder was reportedly changed about a month before the murders because he complained about weight gain. Sources say his meds still aren't stabilized. He checked into a Santa Monica hotel after the alleged killings, then was found wandering near USC the following night. The murder weapon still has not been recovered, and legal experts are saying that this case won't see a courtroom for at least 2 years. Joining me to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's put on our behavioral analysis hats for a moment. Nick Reiner reportedly cycled through 18 plus rehab facilities over 3 decades, checking in, detoxing just long enough to satisfy the family, then leaving before any sort of real psychiatric work actually could take place. When you look at that sort of a pattern, what does it tell you about whether we're dealing with genuine treatment resistance here with somebody or a calculated system of manipulation?
I think it's a little bit of both, Tony. We keep looking at this case, and every time I look at this case, I'm trying to take a different optic and lens on it. And so this time, I'm really focusing, like you said, on those 18 times in rehab. Mm-hmm. I've been around, and we've talked about this before, we all have been around a lot of addiction with different people, different circumstances. And here's what really gets me with this one, especially since the statement he made about wanting to change his meds, the reason for it, that's when it really resonated with me. And that was everything he's doing continues to be all about him, appearances, self-centeredness. Someone that eventually does get into rehab and wants to reform and wants to embrace and wants to get healthy and clean and overcome addiction owns it. They mm-hmm. own their behavior, and and that's the first thing is you let go. You just mm-hmm. let go and admit that you're powerless. And he never did that once. I think everything was a control, a show, and never let go of 100% the victim mentality. The world is doing this to me. I'm the victim of a conspiracy. I'm gaining weight. It's me, 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 me. And when you're surrounded by a lot of loving people, not necessarily loving critics, they're going to keep exasperating that potentially. But anyway, regardless, 18 times that this person did not embrace the fact that they are doing something wrong, not society.
Yeah. And at this point, I hear exactly what you're saying. I think that both can be, you know, parallelly true at the same time, where at this point, maybe he, you know, really is thinking there's a conspiracy out against him. I mean, maybe that's legitimate. It's not just, you know, part of the ploy of I'm going to have to play crazy right now in order to get a lesser sentence and not go to prison. Any path here is likely going to lead to some sort of a confined existence beyond just where he's sitting in jail right now. Very likely, even if he does go down the not guilty by reason of insanity, or maybe pleads guilty mm-hmm. by reason of insanity, which could be a possibility there. A facility is certainly in his future. The not guilty route, I think that's a part that terrifies a lot of people, though, because it's the idea that he could get somewhere and be institutionalized for a while. And depending on what that sentence may be or not be, once deemed safe and okay to be out, you know, he's better. could be released. That's not how it always works, though. There's many cases where they are there for a long time. But in that TMZ documentary, it was very interesting. They brought up the Carmichael case out of Canada, which also they had the McNaughton standard basically for proving insanity, basically trying to understand the understanding of what's the word on this one. It's not right and wrong. It's more specifically.
I only know the right and wrong.
I want to make sure I'm the nature and quality. That's it. I got to think of a granola bar every time. Yeah, I think
nature
of it.
And quality.
Nature and quality.
The quality control.
Yeah. So they have to understand the nature and quality of what they were doing was wrong. Carmichael strangled his son. He was going through a medication change, but he also believed that he was basically doing the right thing because in his mind, the medication has told him that he was saving his daughter, that his son was living a miserable life. And this was merciful to do. He knew it was wrong. He knew he was going to face consequences, even looked up like HIV AIDS stats in prison because he was concerned about what was going to happen to him once he was arrested. But he still went through on it because he didn't understand the nature and quality of what he was doing. He believed he was doing it for a different reason, which was obviously not a sane reason, which is why it was not guilty by reason of insanity. Right. He also had no past, no past history of addiction or this and that and everything else. And a history of manipulating people left and right. So it's an interesting comparison because it may be applicable to Nick Reiner on what he was feeling in that exact moment of that exact night. But when you put everything behind it, the 17 years prior, that really creates a different monster, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's a compelling case to look at, but at the same time, from everything I've looked at over the years and the cases we've covered, the bar to get to not guilty by reason of insanity and actually use an insanity plea is really high, much higher, I think, today than it was when I was growing up. At least I used to remember thinking I heard it more when I was growing up. Yeah. And also, but you hit the really key there. It's that lifelong pattern of really abhorrent behavior. And so had this been a one-off where you could say, oh, it was the medication, it was a psychotic event induced by that. And that's why they're going to really rely on a lot of really experienced clinicians in this doing the assessments, because it's not just the change of medication. You know, he has a pattern for 18 rehab attempts of really, really bad, abhorrent, unhealthy behavior for many, many, many years. And I think what will also come out is, you know, the pattern of escalating violence as well, or threat of violence and all those things. So this was not a one-off. So think about this. I think part of the argument for prosecution is probably going to use is this thing called choice. Mm-hmm. For 18 attempts, he made a choice that he was the victim. Granted, there's a lot of things going on in the brain with chemical imbalances and crap when you're under addiction. But at the same time, though, he constantly kept making a choice. Granted, it was a choice induced by drugs or whatnot, but he's still making a choice. So for a very long time, he is being responsible for his action, or should be accountable for his actions to stay in those types of situations when given so many opportunities to make a choice to get yourself clean, get yourself out. And so I think that's going to weigh very heavily on this case of that pattern of crazy.
It's going to be interesting, you know, and that's a question that I've been asking some of our attorney friends about this, or I'm going to be asking more of in the coming weeks as this continues to develop, is, you know, what exactly would be admissible in a case like this if it ever gets to trial, which I'm going to guess this may end in a plea. But if this actually does get to trial, how much of Nick's bad acts in the past are going to be allowable into this? I think it certainly tells part of the story, and you'd certainly need the context. But how much gets in? Does 18 rehabs get in, or is it just a history of, you know, it's going to be played a certain way depending on who's looking at this. And what exactly can be looked at in front of a jury should it get there in terms of he's made these choices in the past over and over and over, and they were always the wrong ones. They were always self-serving. Or does the jury only get to see the snapshot of that 48 hours and that night and just a snapshot of, yeah, see, when someone's going through a medication change, horrible things can happen to the brain. And this is what happened. Case closed.
You know, it's hard to imagine a situation, though, where a lot of people that had a lot of contact with him, including his siblings, which apparently mm-hmm. don't look like they're going to stand with him on this, wouldn't be called to bear witness to his behavior and lifestyle and all these other things. You know, I think one of the greatest things that's going to be a great resource for prosecution is all the people in the Reiners' lives. The transparency they had as a family with what they were dealing with meant they were broadcasting these things out. And so I don't think this, in other words, we've dealt with cases where there's a lot of hidden things where where things weren't being shared publicly or kept in shadows. I don't think that's the case here. There's a lot of people that, because the Reiners were who they were, because of their transparency as a family, because of the vulnerability of who they were let into their lives, and because of the kindness and generosity that the Reiners had, a lot of people want to be on their side. So you're going to get a lot of testimony, I would say, against Nick. I mean, we talked about it last show. He's not likable. And when you're not likable, the people you murdered are likable. And you have all these people extremely aware of your behavior for a very, very, very long time. That's a very tough road, I think, for defense to climb, no matter what's admissible or inadmissible, regardless. People can talk and share their thoughts and opinions and their experiences.
TMZ reported that the family had basically grown used to Nick. I mean, that's understandable. It's basically conditioning. You sit there long enough with that sort of behavior around you, and I mean, you kind of get used to it. And what one on the outside may look at as being very extreme, when you're next to it every single day, you don't realize it. It's the frog in the boiling pot of water, or however you want to look at it. You know, that being said, I'm very curious as to what we are going to find out about life in that Reiner home, not just in those weeks leading up to this, but in the years, in the lifetime of the upbringing of the other kids' childhoods. They haven't spoken anything yet other than the brief statements that they've given. But if this makes it to trial, I'm gonna guess they're gonna be witnesses. And I'm gonna guess we're gonna hear a lot about things in that home, a lot of struggles that we were not privy to. And I'm guessing it's probably gonna be somewhat shocking to a lot of people. I think it's good because it's gonna raise awareness as this already has for this sort of thing that's going on. So if there's a silver lining in this, that might be more of it. But I'm wondering what we're going to hear and how that's going to be parsed out and phrased by the siblings on this. Is it going to be parsed out in a way of, we are frustrated as shit and Nick deserves everything he has coming to him because of his poor decisions? Or are we going to hear much more of a mental health struggle story and siblings that certainly want him to face consequences, but are more so telling it from a perspective of, it's not as cut and dry and he's an evil addict as a lot of folks are going to be looking at this at. Ultimately, it's going to be a very fascinating story to hear.
Yeah, it will be. Again, my thinking hat on and my thought process says that when you have such lengthy years of exposure to this behavior, that, again, just my thought on it is that it was a household full of kindness, compassion, fear, and a lot of trauma bonding, of walking on eggshells, where you're waiting for, like, he's holding a good day, Nick holding a good day out for you in hopes that you're going to get one today if you behave a certain way. And so it's hard not to build up resentment at some point, no matter what, because you can imagine, again, your thought experiment had on that, all right, early on when they recognize we have mental health issues, all right, so we're gonna do all we can to mitigate those mental health issues. And we do all the things, we get rehab, and we see doctors, psychiatrists, we get prescriptions, and it doesn't work. All right, we're full of kindness, we're full of grace, we're understanding of the mental health crisis and all that. We'll try this, we'll do it again. And they're all in, compassion, grace, all the things that good, beautiful, healthy families have, and it fails again. Yeah. All right, so you see the exasperation starts to build. And at a certain point, when you're not the parents and you are siblings and other people in their lives, you know, you're going to hit the tipping point where I think resentment starts building. When resentment starts building, watch out, because that is where people aren't necessarily going to be giving you the grace anymore, because resentment in this case would start building because we gave you all the chances to stop being a victim. We gave you the chances to take control of your life. Everyone's on your, in other words, everyone was on his side, yet he rejected it, saying, I'm still the victim. You're all against me. Yeah. And so that, I can only imagine, again, the thought experiment of that is probably what's, I was going to guess would be the standpoint of the siblings and the friends and family.
And it's an interesting standpoint on this, you know, where he is saying it's a conspiracy. I can see how he would feel like it's a conspiracy, like
a righteous one.
Yeah, it's a righteous one, finally, but everything has flipped on him. Everything that was working, it was like he was in the bizarro conspiracy forever,
right,
of upside down land, where like this really shouldn't be a conspiracy, but it seems to be, to enable you to keep going in every which way, shape, and form. And now it's finally the other way. You know, if your brain is already fairly broken, the way he's describing it from his perspective, it kind of is a conspiracy, just how he's thinking of it. You know?
Yeah, it was a conspiracy to finally do what should have been done by all the people around him. I mean, so I agree, it is a conspiracy. He's actually, it's probably the most accurate thing he said in a very long time. It was a conspiracy of everyone in your life that finally said, screw you. You went over the top. You killed your parents. The grace is gone. And the kind of going back to what you opened with, the thought of him not, you know, being able to say not guilty because of reason of insanity, the thought of eventually getting out or getting away with, I mean this is one of those cases where this is a broken brain that cannot be fixed.
There's
no fixing this brain.
The question is now how many millions of dollars and how much resources are going to go into getting to this conclusion that everybody already knows the answer to.
And that's
where we're at. And obviously we'll keep digging into this as it continues. Give us your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and also on our Substack channel, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is also in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. Is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The Nick Reiner insanity defense. I know a lot of us are like, we don't want to hear it. He deserves to go. And he does. He deserves to face consequences for his actions. But let's take a little bit deeper dive into this, into the insanity defense, what it actually means in California, because there's another case that took place in Canada, which has a very similar insanity type defense that can be argued in court as California does, and how all that worked out. I'm going to explain the case to you and let you decide in your own opinions what's right, what's wrong, what's appropriate, what's not. I'm just going to lay it out there so you can fully grasp this, because this is a confusing case when it comes down to it. It's not as cut and dry as one would like to make it. And it all comes down to the definition of insanity and being in a psychotic state, in a psychotic break. What does that mean? And why are you in it? And how are you processing things? Let's Let's get into all this. And while we do, in the comment section on YouTube, I'd love to get your thoughts. If you're not already there, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is where you will find us. Our Substack, you can also comment and interact directly with me here in the studio. If you really want me to see your comment for sure, be sure to leave it on our Substack. That link is in the description. It's on the bottom of the screen on YouTube right now, hiddenkillers.substack.com. So two ways to interact and get your opinion heard. YouTube and our Substack. All right, two cases here. Two men who killed family members they were supposed to love. Two very different outcomes. One walked out of a psychiatric facility after about 2 years, free. Today, that man tours Canada giving speeches about prescription drug safety. The other is sitting in a Los Angeles jail right now, facing the death penalty, reportedly unable to understand why he's there. The legal standard that saved the first one could theoretically save the second. The question isn't whether the defense exists, it's whether anyone should believe it when Nick Reiner tries to use it, because these are very different cases. One is a guy with a history of addiction and making poor choices time and time again when being brought back to the shore while drowning. The other had a med change. Both actually had med changes. One has a documented long history of choosing wrongly, of choosing poorly, of choosing things that will disrupt an active participation in his own recovery. The other had a med change. I think that context is important, but when it comes to this actually getting to trial and being argued in a courtroom, you can damn well bet the defense of Nick Reiner wants nothing of prior bad acts coming in to that jury's purview. They want to look specifically at the moment, at the incident, and go, see, because of this, that happened. And in a way, when you're looking at it with that kind of blinders, that is a true statement. But how did he get here? How did we get to that point? And I think a lot of people would argue that without all of this, that wouldn't have taken place to begin with. But again, that's not always how trials work. That's not how our court system works. That's not how innocent and guilty verdicts are always rendered. It doesn't always go to the common sense standard as it should, but it is what it is. So let's start with David Carmichael, because what happened in that London, Ontario hotel room in July of 2004 is going to matter a lot in the Los Angeles courtroom sometime in the next few years, if this banks it to trial. This is that similar case in moment of medication change. That's why we're talking about this. And like I just said, identifying all of the other minutiae, it's more than minutiae, all of the other factors leading up to this moment. Carmichael was a fitness advocate, a youth sports coach, a devoted father. By every account, his 11-year-old son, Ian, had mild epilepsy controlled by medication, but was otherwise a healthy, happy, energetic kid. On July 31st of 2004, Carmichael took his son, Ian, to a hotel under the pretense of a dirt biking trip. They had dinner together, watched Ian's favorite movie, and then Carmichael crushed sleeping pills into a glass of orange juice, gave it to his son, waited for the drugs to take effect, and then strangled him to death. Here's where it gets complicated. This wasn't impulsive. Carmichael had researched the difference between first-degree and second-degree murder online. He'd visited the Correctional Service of Canada website. He'd look into HIV and AIDS in prison. He was planning to spend 25 years behind bars. He knew exactly what the legal consequences would be. And he did it anyway. Charged with first-degree murder, and the verdict, not criminally responsible. He was sent to a psychiatric facility, released after approximately 2 years, and he's walking free today. How does that happen? How does a man who planned a killing research the charges? expected decades in prison end up not responsible for the death of his own child? Because a legal standard that most people don't understand, that's how. But you're going to understand it if you continue watching this video, and it's important. I'm not saying because it's right, I'm saying because it exists. And if you'd like to have a conversation about this case in any sort of educated adult manner, understanding the principles of it are important, like them or not. That same standard is about to become very relevant in the case of Nick Reiner. Most people think the insanity defense means you don't know right from wrong. That's the version we get from the movies and TV, but that's only half of the test. Under the McNaughton rule, which is used in Canada and in California, there are two ways to establish legal insanity. First, that you didn't know your act was wrong. Second, that you didn't understand the nature and quality of your act. You only have to prove one. Carmichael knew killing was wrong. He expected prison. He planned for it. That prong was never going to work for him. The second prong, nature and quality. That's what set him free. What does nature and quality mean, other than something that you see on a lot of granola bars and then you read the nutrition label and you're like, what? This isn't nature and quality. After you've eaten it, going, oh my God, I thought that was healthy. It's not about whether you understand the mechanics. Carmichael understood he was ending a life. It's about whether you understood what you were actually doing, the true reality of the act. And that's it's a hard one to prove in court. You're asking to go into someone's brain and say, how did you perceive this through your prism at that moment in time? And why should I believe what you're telling me right now when you have a very clear reason to tell me a specific thing to get a lesser penalty? Here's what the psychiatric evaluations revealed. In the weeks before that, Carmichael had started taking Paxil, an SSRI antidepressant for mild depression. Shortly after, he entered a psychotic state. He became convinced that his healthy son was severely brain damaged, that he was living in hell, tormented by other children, that Ian was dangerous and would eventually kill his older sister. None of this was true. Ian was fine. But in Carmichael's fractured reality, due to the drugs not interacting with his biology very well, he wasn't murdering a healthy child. He was performing an act of mercy in his mind. He was saving his son from a tortured existence in his mind. Both the prosecution psychiatrist and the defense's psychiatrist agreed major depression with psychotic episodes, incapable of rational decision-making. The delusion was real, and because Carmichael didn't understand the true nature of what he was doing, because in his mind, he was ending suffering, not committing murder, he met the legal standard for insanity. Once he was stabilized on proper medication, Carmichael understood what he'd done. He grieved. He accepted the horror of it. He'd spoken publicly about the guilt that he carries. But legally, the illness drove the act, and the law doesn't hold people responsible for things they couldn't understand they were doing. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just stating fact of how that has played out. I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions in the comments. Let's talk about Nick Reiner now. December 14th, 2025, Brentwood, California. Nick Reiner, 32 years old, stabbed both of his parents to death in their home, allegedly. His father, Rob Reiner, 78. His mother, Michelle Singer Reiner, 70. Sources say they were awake when it happened. Nick was charged with two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, death penalty eligible. The night before, the Reiners had taken Nick to Conan O'Brien's holiday party. They were reportedly afraid to leave him alone. At the party, Nick was freaking everyone out, according to sources, acting erratically, asking guests if they were famous, getting into a loud argument with his father. Other guests considered calling 911. The Reiners apologized and left. A family source told reporters they'd grown used to this kind of behavior. Hours later, Rob and Michelle were dead. Here's where the Carmichael parallels come in. Nick was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder around 2020. It's a brutal condition. It combines schizophrenia symptoms like delusion and hallucinations with more severe mood swings, including mania and depression. Sources say Nick was stable on his medication. Then, about a month before the murders, doctors changed his prescription. And the reason? Nick complained about weight gain, a common side effect of antipsychotic meds. So they switched him to something else. According to TMZ's recent reporting, that change messed Nick up profoundly. He became erratic, agitated, increasingly dangerous. His parents saw the spiral happening. They didn't know what to do. Sources say doctors did an attempt to put Nick on a psychiatric hold during the transition, a hold that could have lasted 14 days, could have contained him while they figured out the medication. That did not happen. And here's the part that sounds like Carmichael all over again. Nick reportedly admits he killed his parents. He's not claiming innocence, allegedly. He's claiming he doesn't remember. He knows what he did. He's not claiming he doesn't remember. I got to say that correctly. He's not claiming he doesn't remember, allegedly. He knows what he did. But according to sources, he believes his incarceration is a conspiracy against him. He doesn't understand why he's being punished. Now, are we to believe the man who has the track record of manipulating and lying and admitting about doing all these things? Now saying, you know I did it, but I didn't know I did it, or I didn't understand what I was doing. It's a conspiracy. I mean, if you're going to need to play the crazy card, which Nick kind of needs to play the crazy card right now, if he's going to be going in his own self-interest and not the interest of reality and admission to crimes, you would go down that road. He has the track record of the manipulation, though. Carmichael? No, not so much. But let's for a second say that that's exactly what's going on here. It does sound somewhat familiar to the Carmichael case. A medication change triggers destabilization. I'm not saying that it couldn't be true, that all of this could not exist in the same reality. Years and years of manipulation, and then finally, when it comes to this horrible point of destruction, he's making this claim that he thinks it's a conspiracy. He may very well think it's a conspiracy. The days of manipulation may be gone. His brain may be so fried that what sounds like manipulation is actually very much his reality. The paranoia, the confusion, the conspiratorial type thinking. Or it's all another ruse to face less consequences. And if years and years of doing that and manipulating people ended you here, and this is where you got, and now you really truly don't know, and when you cry wolf, nobody knows what to believe you or not. Well, maybe that's just the consequences of the action, and that's just tough shit. And you now get to live in the utter hell that you've created for yourself because of your years of doing this to yourself. Despite every opportunity to be pulled up and pulled out into a much safer and happier existence, you chose the latter every time. That's the mental illness. That's the disease. There's plenty of people with these same sort of diagnoses that are living happy, healthy, productive lives on medications, following recovery. And none of this is part of their reality. Why? Autonomy. Choices. He made them. They have consequences. Again, depends how you look at this case. A medication change triggering destabilization, the person commits a horrific act. They understand the mechanics of what happened, but not the reality of it. That's the Carmichael defense. And that TMZ doc that just came out explicitly laid out that California's legal standard doesn't require proving Nick didn't know killing was wrong. It only requires proving he didn't understand the nature and quality of his actions. Even premeditation doesn't necessarily defeat that defense. Carmichael proved that too. So is it case closed? Nick Reiner walks the same path David Carmichael did? No. There are differences here that matter, and a lot of them. Start with history. David Carmichael had no criminal record, no history of manipulation, no pattern of gaming systems or deceiving people. He was a respected professional, a devoted father, a man whose psychotic break came out of nowhere, clearly triggered by new medication. Every expert who examined him agreed. The delusion was genuine. There was nothing in his past to suggest otherwise. Nick Reiner had 30 years of documented addiction, mental health crises, treatment failures. He went to 18-plus rehab facilities. The pattern was always the same. Check-in, stay 30 days, detox, just enough to satisfy family concerns, then leave before any real psychiatric work could actually happen. He's described himself as manipulative in interviews. His entire adult life has been about working systems and working people. When you've spent three decades learning how to game every institution you encounter, how does anyone prove the psychosis is real and not just the final play? Then there's post-offense behavior. Carmichael was essentially caught at the scene. He didn't flee. He didn't cover his tracks. He didn't navigate the world for 24 hours like nothing happened. Nick Reiner reportedly checked into Pierside Hotel in Santa Monica after the alleged killings. He spent more than a day moving through Los Angeles. He calmly bought a drink at a gas station before being found wandering near USC. That's a problem, and it can be a big one, because you don't book a hotel room if you don't understand what just happened. You don't navigate a major city for 24 hours making purchases, avoiding detection, if you're completely disconnected from reality. That's not someone who didn't understand the nature and quality of his actions. That's presence of mind. That is awareness. The prosecution is going to hammer that hard. There's also the response to stabilization. Once Carmichael's medication was sorted out, he understood the horror of what he'd done. He grieved his son. He accepted it. That's what genuine psychosis looks like when it clears. The person recognizes reality. Nick Reiner, sources say his meds still aren't stabilized in jail. Doctors are still trying to figure it out. He's still reportedly delusional, still believing the conspiracy, or so he says. Maybe that's genuine ongoing psychosis, or maybe it's a narrative being constructed and maintained. With someone who has no history of manipulation, you give them the benefit of the doubt. With someone who spent 30 years manipulating everyone around him, how do you know which one you're looking at? And then there's the delusion itself. We know what Carmichael believed. He thought he was saving his son. It was distorted, broken, completely divorced from reality, but it was internally consistent. He believed Ian was suffering. That he was ending that suffering. What did Nick Reiner believe he was doing? We don't know yet. Was he, in his mind, protecting his parents from something? Defending against a threat only he could see? Or did he understand exactly what was happening and is now constructing the framework to avoid consequences? The defense will argue that the medication change broke Nick's brain. That he was in a psychotic state, not of his choosing. That whatever his history, what matters is his mental state at the time of the crime. That Carmichael proves the standard can apply even with planning, even with awareness of legal consequences. The prosecution will argue that 24 hours of functional behavior proves Nick understood what he did. That his lifetime of manipulation makes the conspiracy claim look like strategy, not delusion. That he requested the medication change himself, prioritizing vanity over stability, which isn't the behavior of someone who doesn't understand his condition. It's the behavior of someone who thinks he can manage the variables. And that when you spend 30 years making sure no one should believe you, you don't get to ask a jury to do so now. Here's the uncomfortable reality. David Carmichael killed his son and walked free, and the system worked. He was a genuinely broken person by medication. He got treatment instead of prison. He's not a danger to society today. That outcome was possible because nothing in Carmichael's history contradicted the psychosis narrative. No pattern of deception. No post-offensive behavior suggesting presence of mind. No reason of doubt. Nick Reiner has all of those things. The legal standard that Save Carmichael exists, it applies in California on paper. Nick Reiner can make the same argument, but making that argument work requires something Nick Reiner has never had in his entire adult life: credibility. Carmichael's freedom came because everyone believed the delusion was real. Every expert, every piece of evidence, every element of his history supported it. Nick Reiner's fate is going to come down to whether 12 people can look at 30 years of manipulation, 18 failed rehab stays, 24 hours of post-defense navigation through Los Angeles, and a conspiracy claim that sounds an awful lot like a lifelong pattern of avoiding accountability, and somehow believe that this time he's telling the truth. It's a harder sell than any defense attorney wants to make, and it may be the only card Nick Reiner has left to play. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and weigh in. Or you can weigh in with your comments on our Substack. It is absolutely free to join right now. There is no paywall up, and you can get access to all of our reporting a day before it goes out to the rest of the world. So you get advanced episodes, you get them ad-free, and you get them on a very nice, clear, clean, tidy platform that I check all the time. So if you'd like to interact directly with me and have your opinion maybe expressed here on the show or get me to see it, then join our Substack. That's the best way to do that. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description. It's also on the screen right now if you're watching us on YouTube. And if you're listening to us, because people consume this show every way, shape, and form, podcast, video, whatever. If you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, specifically Apple Podcast right now, hit subscribe, but please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. When you leave us a review, if you find this reporting valuable, it signals to everyone else that you feel that way, and then it feeds it to other people. It's how it works, and we kind of have to operate within that ecosystem. So if you could do your part, if you're enjoying this this reporting and these commentaries, please do leave us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. Tell us why you like the show. And tell the world why you like the show. And then hit submit. That helps us. And I do thank you in advance for leaving that review. I really, really do. Looking forward to your thoughts. We'll continue it off the air. Join me over there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.